Donc, on va passer à la prochaine intervention. Et là, on est, comme j'avais annoncé, maintenant en train d'avancer vers le 19e siècle. Donc, Sunil Amrit enseigne donc à Birkbeck College, à l'Université de Londres. Il a fait sa thèse à Cambridge et il a donc publié jusque-là deux livres importants portant sur les rapports entre l'Asie du Sud et l'Asie du Sud-Est, notamment un livre qui vient de sortir chez Harvard University Press il n'y a pas si longtemps que ça, portant sur un sujet qui a un lien avec le sujet d'aujourd'hui, c'est-à-dire autour de l'histoire du golfe de Bengale à l'époque coloniale. Donc aujourd'hui, il va nous parler de Rupture and Continuity in the Bay of Bengal's 19th Century History. Merci d'avoir pris le retard pour venir nous voir.
Thank you very much, Professor Subramaniam, for this very kind invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. Coming towards the end of our 2 days' discussion, this paper does stand at the outer temporal boundary of our colloquium's theme. I speak primarily as a historian of the 20th century, albeit one finding myself drawn further back in time in trying to understand the connections between South and Southeast Asia. And my talk is motivated today in part by the sharpest chronological divide in the historiography of the Indian Ocean, which Sanjay invoked yesterday in the opening remarks. And that is a curtain drawn around the end of the 18th or the beginning of the 19th century. The long-established and flourishing historiography of the early modern Indian Ocean, of which there are so many exponents here today, rarely ventures beyond 1800. By contrast, the more recent move to write the modern history of the Indian Ocean rarely reaches back beyond 1850, and indeed most of the recent work on cosmopolitanism and print culture in the Indian Ocean world focuses very much on the period from the 1870s or even the 1890s to the 1920s. What I'd like to begin to do is to open up some sort of conversation between these two historiographies by looking again at the 19th century and by looking in particular at the history of the Bay of Bengal, which, as Sanjay Subramaniam has argued for the early modern period, was a far more tightly knit unit of interaction than the Indian Ocean as a whole. This remains true, indeed becomes ever more true, in the 19th century. Indeed, by the end of the 19th century, the Bay of Bengal was unequivocally the most densely connected part of the Indian Ocean, especially in terms of migration, but also to arguably in terms of capital movements. The two great ruptures of the 19th century were the question of scale and of political control. And I would like to devote most of my talk today to the question of periodizing these ruptures, and most especially periodizing the two leaps in scale when it comes to the connectivity across the Bay of Bengal, but also to think a little bit about the limitations and the fractures that underlay those transitions. The scale of human mobility in the Bay of Bengal in the 19th century dwarfed all that had preceded it. Indeed, circular movement around the Bay of Bengal was one of the largest mass movements of people in global history by the 1890s. I would like to suggest, though, that closer attention to the Bay of Bengal's 19th century history can tease out multiple transitions through which we can glimpse some of the ways in which smaller circulations, rooted in the bay's history, continued to underpin these massive transformations of scale in the Bay of Bengal's connectivity. I would like to look first at the ways in which that first surge of migration to Ceylon in the 1840s reverberated around the bay and in fact set the groundwork for the much larger expansion of migration that took place at the end of the 1870s. Even after the triumph of the steamship, the Bay of Bengal continued to be linked by Tamil, Hindu and Muslim shipping merchants, by methods of labor recruitment with deep roots in Tamil society, and by relatively ungoverned circulations of belief and ritual, some of which had very deep roots. Even through the establishment of imperial control, that is to say, lateral connections across the Bay of Bengal, I think remained important. I would like to begin with the question of scale, and with the chronology of the circular migration around the Bay of Bengal to establish the moments of transition that I would then like to look at in greater depth. Given the profusion of beautiful manuscripts we have seen over the past 2 days, I apologize in advance for the brute utilitarianism of what is to follow. This presents passenger arrivals and departures to Ceylon from South India between the 1840s and the 1870s. And you can see that already by the 1850s, this movement had grown to come close to 100,000 arrivals a year. This drops off with the collapse of Ceylon's coffee industry in the 1860s before reviving again after 1880, which is not on this graph. As you can see, between half and three quarters of the people, the number of people who arrived in India every year returned. And because these are passenger arrivals and departures, it is not, we're not talking about this many individuals necessarily, because circular migration was the norm, and these numbers might well include second, third, fourth time journeys over the course of 10 or 20 years. This is the equivalent number of arrivals and departures to the Straits settlements and Malaya, and you can see how much smaller the numbers are than Ceylon. We're talking about an order of about 10. Nevertheless, by the 1840s, you can see a gradual increase in the quantity of migration between South India in particular and the Straits settlements and Malaya, again, coming close to 10,000 people a year by the 1850s into the 1860s. To jump forward in time a little bit, just to bring Burma into the story, this is the end of the 19th century, and by this point you can see that arrivals in Ceylon at the turn of the 20th century are in excess of 200,000 people a year. These are arrivals only. The number of departures remains sort of 70 to 80% of this. Burma, well in excess of 100,000 by the beginning of the 20th century, and Malaya too, always a slightly smaller number, but nevertheless catching up by the eve of the First World War. Just two more graphs and then I promise I'll stop. Net immigration to Malaya, which you can see does begin to accelerate from the 1870s. There's a blip. I won't go into the 20th century story, but you can see a blip around the time of the Depression. And a similar graph for Sri Lanka. And you can see that net immigration to Sri Lanka is greater than Malaya for most of the period that I'm talking about. The nature of the data themselves, of course, tell a very interesting story, and it is a familiar story. The increasing surveillance and regulation of human mobility across the Bay of Bengal, the increasing concern of colonial states with enumerating, categorizing, and regulating different populations. These data are drawn from an amalgam of shipping registers, port records of arrivals and departures, government reports, and census data. But they're full of gaps. I don't think one could pretend that there is anything like a good level of accuracy in this data. These are ballpark figures. And in fact, the inconsistencies, the holes, even the fictions are just as revealing, I think, as the numbers and the ways in which they were generated in terms of making some of the points that I'm going to go on to make about the nature of this migration, how far this migration was under official control, and the various kinds of circulations that might well have taken place outside the purview of the statistics collection. I would like to focus the rest of the paper then on two key points of acceleration, two key moments of inflection. The first is the mid-1840s, when you see the rise of migration to Ceylon, and the second is the beginning of the 1880s, when you see an acceleration of migration to Malaya and the beginnings of mass migration to Burma. The beginning of mass migration from South India to Ceylon in the 1840s serves as a sort of fulcrum in my story. On the one hand, it developed out of very deeply rooted traditions of labour circulation across the Palk Strait, and at the same time, it paved the way for the expansion of plantation capital around the Bay of Bengal, and for the specific mechanisms through which labour was recruited for these plantations. As Eric Mayer's work has suggested, for centuries workers and artisans had moved temporarily or permanently between South India and Ceylon. For centuries, fishing communities and petty traders lived across both sides of the Palk Strait. British attempts to exploit more intensively the islands natural resources created by the second or third decade of the 19th century a hunger for Indian labour. The conquest of Ceylon's interior by force with roads and bridges depended on Indian soldiers and corvée labour. With the decline in the value of cinnamon, British planters staked their fortunes on coffee, and that is what required this massive acceleration in the arrival of Indian labour. An immense alteration will be effected in the heretofore desert wastes of the island, one planter predicted at the dawn of the 1840s. In the 1840s, as you can see, labour migration between South India and Ceylon exploded. It rose to an early peak of 80,000 arrivals in 1844, falling away as the coffee industry sank into depression, reviving with the planters' fortunes to approach nearly 100,000 arrivals annually by the late 1850s. Labour recruiters known in Tamil as Kanganis were central to the process, and they would become key figures in the Bay of Bengal's entire history of migration. In the early years, most Kanganis were simply the appointed spokesmen of gangs of labourers who travelled together from South India. Others, over time, became what we might think of more as professional labour recruiters, who gathered up willing, at times unwilling, migrants in South India and delivered them to several different coffee plantations in Ceylon. Many Kanganis were existing plantation workers sent back by their employers to recruit more men on commission. And needless to say, debt was essential to the system. Kanganis advanced money to the families of the labour recruits, known in the case of Ceylon as the Coast Advance. Once indebted, the migrants remained in the Kanganis' power, not least because the Kanganis tended to manage the provision stores on the plantations from which workers were compelled to buy their provisions. Where they operated on a small scale, recruiting largely amongst their fellow villagers, relations of caste and kinship could also moderate the Kanganis' power. Yet such intimacy could make the bonds of debt more pervasive still. And this takes me from commerce to croyance, albeit in a slightly different way than we have heard so far. All kinds of circulations accompanied this movement of labour. Circulations initially, at least, ungoverned by planters or the state. Very strikingly, the first invocation I have ever seen of a Tamil diaspora, the use of that term, was in fact by an English clergyman named Norman Sargent, who wrote a 1940 book called The Dispersion of the Tamil Church. In it, Sargent excavates the history of Tamil Christianity as it moved from South India to Ceylon and Malaya in the 19th century. W.E. Rowlands, who led the so-called Tamil Coolie Mission in the mid-1840s, described how in the early days of coffee cultivation in Ceylon, English planters were, quote, astonished to hear hymn singing in the coffee stores. These workers, in advance of any missionary presence in the interior, were worshipping the true God in a strange land. Tamil catechists from Tirunelveli Mission followed, but the movement of religious ideas and practices, as so often, followed their own paths. And from here on, the true faith was taken around the Bay of Bengal as people were, quote, constantly going and coming to their own villages while others crossed the sea to new fields of labour in Malaya. And indeed, looking at the archives of the Tamil Methodist Church of Singapore, one finds that the Ceylon connection, as you move through the 19th century, is very strong indeed. In handwritten lists of inquirers and baptisms, family histories linking Ceylon to Malaya are really quite widespread. Needless to say, the circulation and transformation of popular Hinduism took place on a significantly larger scale still. The connection between the upsurge of migration to Ceylon and the later movement of Tamil labour to Malaya were direct, and they emerged right as early as the 1840s. And this is one way in which these distinct waves of migration need to be complicated and connected. The first sort of connection is the most straightforward. It was ecological. Experiments in coffee cultivation arrived in Malaya by way of Ceylon, and indeed many of the early coffee planters in Malaya actually moved there from Ceylon, having prior experience of creating plantations in Sri Lanka. Ceylon's planters were accustomed to working with Tamil labour, and they maintained this source of supply when they moved across the bay to Malaya. In a formative way, then, the links between Ceylon and Malaya helped to explain why Tamil districts played such an overwhelming role in sending labour to Malaya, unlike Burma, for example, where Telugu districts predominated. The Ceylon coffee planters in Malaya had an even more lasting effect by introducing the Kangani system of labour recruitment. Coffee estates relied on Kangani recruitment, though we have very sketchy evidence of how this worked prior to the 1870s or 1880s. But it's clear that the existence of prior networks of Kangani recruitment in Malaya are what allowed for the massive expansion of this form of labour migration after 1880. If migration to Ceylon was most clearly an extension of earlier traditions of movement, it built on proximity and deep connection. Movement over the longer distance to Malaya required more work on the part of the state and employers. So in Malaya, Kangani recruitment coexisted with and eventually displaced the system of indentured labour, which was used mostly on Malaya's coffee rather than... indentured labour was used on sugar rather than coffee estates. And it was adapted directly from the earlier migration of Indian workers to the sugar colonies of the Indian Ocean and the West Indies. Malaya, that is to say, drew on both the wider Indian Ocean history of indentured labour and on specific networks that had linked South India to Ceylon and which then expanded to encompass the bay. The soil is good, one Malayan planter wrote as early as 1836. The climate is fine and naught is waiting but the hands of men to bring abundance to our doors. And in the 19th century, those hands came almost exclusively from South India. As sugar cultivation expanded in the 1850s in Province Wellesley, the hinterland to Penang, demand for Indian labour intensified. Distance meant shipping costs to Malaya were inevitably greater than to Ceylon, and to recover their investments, brokers insisted that labourers sign contracts of indenture of between 3 and 5 years. Speculators in India gathered up recruits and dispatched them across the bay. And planters raised their own recruits, working with two particular agencies. One, the Scottish presence was ubiquitous, Adamson, Taggart and Company, and two Indian firms, run by Ganapati Pillai and the Madura Company. And between them, these three recruitment firms supplied the majority of the indentured migrant labourers that went to Malaya up to the 1870s and 1880s. Between 1866, when detailed statistics began, and 1910, when indentured labour was abolished in Malaya, up to 250,000 workers moved from India to Malaya under contracts of indenture, and yet, at most, they made up 10% of the total labour migration to Malaya over the longer term, stretching from the 1850s to the 1930s. That is to say, by the turn of the 20th century, Kangani recruitment was paramount, and a revised version of the Ceylon model, one might argue, had prevailed. A major difference being the very small number of women who migrated to Malaya in comparison with Ceylon, where by the 1880s and 1890s, family migration was much more common. Long before the mass migrations of the 1880s, Hindu sacred landscapes could be found in Malaya. This is a contemporary photograph of a small tree shrine on a Malayan rubber plantation. And there are textual and ethnographic sources suggesting that the earliest plantations all had small shrines, many of which developed over the course of the 19th century into much larger temples. Observing in 1834 a performance in the sugar-producing agrarian hinterland of Penang of the rite of Thaipusam, an annual celebration of Murugan, James Lowe, British colonial administrator, wrote that when people forsake their own country and voluntarily settle in another, they should be satisfied with the permission to celebrate their religious rites only which do not outrage the proper feelings of other portions of the community. And indeed, the conflict over Thaipusam processions would continue right through the 19th and 20th centuries. A third thread connecting the Ceylon experience of the 1840s with the mass expansion of Bay of Bengal's economic connections later in the century lies in its impetus to the expansion of Chettiar money-lending networks across the bay. By the 1820s, the Chettiars had a dominant position in the trade between the rice trade between Madras and Ceylon. They supplied the growing plantations of Ceylon with rice and credit. They used their position to expand into financing the expansion of indigenous small holdings of coconut and coffee, which developed alongside the European-owned plantation economy, which was financed by British exchange banks. From Ceylon, Chettiar networks expanded right across the Bay of Bengal, to Burma and Malaya, and further afield to French Indochina and the Dutch East Indies. Raman Mahadevan's work on the Chettiars in the 1970s remains unsurpassed in its depth and detail, and he showed just how important Chettiar finance was in the Straits settlements right up to the 1870s. They were the chief source of credit to small and medium-sized Chinese merchants. Most of the Straits' opium trade passed through their hands. The mass migration of Indian labor to Burma after 1880 would have been impossible without the central role of Chettiars in financing the expansion of Burma's rice frontier. Interestingly, though, much of the development of the Chettiars' business in Southeast Asia is based on retrospective evidence. In particular, the Ceylon and Burma banking inquiries of 1929-30, which collected exhaustive testimony, but also in written Tamil sources produced by the Chettiar community, really it is difficult to find them before the 1920s and 30s. So there is a large extent to which this 19th century history of Chettiar expansion is partly reconstructed from later sources, though of course there are many 19th century sources, including legal sources, which give us an inkling of their depth and penetration of the Southeast Asian economy. There is no question that the opening of the Suez Canal and the spread of the steamship technology around the Bay of Bengal served as a catalyst for a fundamental change of scale by the end of the 1870s. This was indeed part of a global acceleration. But if we look at the Bay of Bengal's own chronology, things are slightly less clear-cut. The process of land clearance and deforestation in the interior were already well underway. So too was the cultural transformation of landscapes through labor and sacralization. And some of the networks of the age of sail persisted even as they adapted to the age of steam. This is a map of British India Steam Navigation Company's passenger shipping routes from 1890, and it would be very interesting to sort of overlay that above an early modern map of Indian Ocean shipping. Partly because the small ports remain on the network and they remain connected across the Bay of Bengal, albeit in new ways and albeit with a greater concentration around the ports of Nagapattinam and Madras in particular. Beginning in the 1860s, the British India Steam Navigation Company did establish a growing hold over passenger shipping across the bay. In 1861, they launched a monthly steamer service between Calcutta, Akyab and Rangoon. Within a decade, fortnightly and then weekly steamer services connected Rangoon with the ports of the eastern coast north of Madras. By the 1880s, a weekly steamer service ran from Madras, Pondicherry, Cuddalore, Karaikal, Nagapattinam to Penang and Singapore. Coinciding with this shipping map, the movement between India and Burma really took off in the 1880s. And it was far more diverse in its composition than migration to Ceylon or Malaya. Most migrants to Burma came not from the Tamil-speaking districts, but from the Telugu-speaking area north of Madras at today's Andhra Pradesh coast, or Sim Andhra coast. They were joined by migrants from the Tamil region, from Orissa, and from Bengal. And adding to the arrivals by sea, of course, an older overland movement continued back and forth around the Bengal Delta, from Chittagong into Burma and back again. Unlike in Ceylon or in Malaya, Burma's development did not depend on plantation agriculture. There, Indian migrant labor was dispersed across a very wide range of occupations. They were as likely to work in small-scale industry as on the land. They were less concentrated in particular workplaces. In this sense, migration to Burma was the freest of the three. But the system of debt and advances played a similar role in enabling migration. Two further contrasts stand out between Burma on the one hand and Ceylon and Malaya on the other. The first was juridical. Burma was ruled as a province of British India. Indian migrants to Burma were therefore, in the eyes of the colonial state, domestic migrants, despite having crossed the bay, And as such, they came under far less control and surveillance by the colonial state. For that reason, amongst others, our statistics for migration to Burma are far, far less certain than Malaya or Ceylon, where the numbers are relatively reliable. Secondly, in Burma, South Indian capital, and not just labour, was essential to the transformations of the late 19th century. Viewed in aggregate, each of the great migrations to Ceylon, Burma, and Malaya had its own social and geographical dynamic. The Telugu districts, as I've just mentioned, provided Burma with most of its labour. The deep south of Tamil Nadu was most closely linked with Ceylon. Thanjavur, Tirunelveli, and the area around Madras with Malaya. But there was sufficient overlap between these routes that they intersected. Within particular villages, for example, even within single families, men, and we are talking mostly of men, would take their chances with different destinations. There were many family histories I came across where one brother would try his luck in Burma, another in Malaya, another in Ceylon. They spread their bets, mitigated the enormous risks that they took. Others' journeys were more sequential. They encompassed the Bay of Bengal within a lifetime. A few years in Ceylon, a period back in India, before heading on to Burma or Malaya. Ceylon and Malaya had an especially close relationship, as I've already suggested was the case from the 1840s, beginning with the planters who took coffee from Ceylon to Malaya, and with them a preference for Tamil labour. By the late 19th century, Tamil families in Sri Lanka sought new frontiers in Malaya. They worked as plantation managers and kanganis, and from the early 20th century, an educated class of Ceylon Tamil migrants filled the ranks of the Straits Settlement's bureaucracy, its law courts. At the same time, one can see increasing competition between recruitment for these different regions. As Sanjay Subramaniam's piece on the pearl fisheries of the Gulf of Mannar points out, by the late 19th century, there was concern that the conventional labour force for the pearl fisheries was increasingly being attracted to migrate to Malaya. And there are very similar stories that one can find in terms of competing imperatives for recruitment. One of the paradoxes of the great acceleration of the 1880s is that the growing intensity of traffic across the Bay of Bengal actually gave way to a much less distinctively maritime world. One way in which we can see this is that most of the people who crossed the Bay of Bengal in the 1880s and 1890s were no longer from the coastal districts. Recruitment pushed further and further inland, and of course at the other end of their journeys, migrants were at least as likely to end up on remote plantations as in the port cities. Consider Malaya. In 1881, Singapore and Penang, the Straits settlements, still accounted for 39 out of 44,000 Indian-born residents enumerated in the census. 39,000 out of 44,000 in 1881 still lived in the cities of Singapore and Penang. By 1901, the combined Indian population of Singapore and Penang was matched by a population of equal size on the plantations of Selangor and Perak. But I would liken the last part of my paper today to turn back to the port cities. They were critical in the transformation of Southeast Asia's frontier. They were the arrival points of migrants from India and China, transit points in the fundamental redistribution of population across the region. And of course, many migrants stayed in the port cities. If migration to plantations outweighed urban migration by the turn of the 20th century, migration to the port cities, which was less governed by the colonial state, more dependent on informal recruitment, nevertheless flourished. Consider that by the turn of the 20th century, the Madras-born population of Singapore, Penang, Rangoon, and Colombo was in each case larger than the total population of all but a handful of cities in Madras presidency. That is to say, the Madras-born populations of Colombo, Rangoon, Singapore, and Penang was greater than the overall population of most cities in South India. And they were an order of magnitude larger than the Madras-born population of any other Indian city outside Madras, including Bombay. So one can see that these remained an urban frontier for South Indian migrants, even while plantation migration began to predominate. And in shaping the social world of the port cities, the Tamil-speaking Muslims of the Marakayar community long connected with both coasts of the Bay of Bengal, as will be familiar to so many of you here, played a significant social and cultural role. And in this last part of my paper, I will consider how the Marakayas adapted to these transitions of the 19th century that I have outlined. Already by 1794, Penang's administrators observed that about 1,000 Chulias, or people from several ports on the coast of Coromandel, were settled in Penang, some of them with families. Many had moved to Penang not directly from India, but from the older settlement of Marakayas in Kedah, which dates back centuries. Many were intermarried with Malay women and formed in Penang a community known as the Jawi Peranakan. From the beginning of the 19th century, and certainly by the 1820s, the urban landscapes of Singapore and Penang bore the imprint of the Tamil Muslim presence. And here I'll return to where Niall Green left off in his paper with the Nagore Dargahs of Penang and Singapore. The Singapore photo is before it was painted peach, a few years before Niall's photograph. Nevertheless, the movement of the followers of the Saint Shahul Hamid of Nagore took place alongside numerous other sorts of religious circulation. Initially, the Marakayas played a very leading role in Penang's trade. A character called Muhammad Nurdin Merikan, and Merikan is the local form in Malaya of Marakayar, was one of Penang's largest merchants in the 1820s and 1830s. To take a sample year, 1838, Muhammad Nurdin dispatched 17 ships from Penang, destined for Chittagong and Arakan, Delhi, Aceh, Pudu and the Pedir coast, Kadlur, Bombay, Nagapattinam, Cochin and Calcutta, Alipi, and Singapore. Marakaya shipping merchants played a crucial role in the gradual expansion of migration, including labour migration that followed the opening of Ceylon's plantation frontier and the spread of plantation production to Malaya. This was accompanied by the rapid development of Singapore and Penang as ports. The sheer number of Marakaya vessels crossing the Bay of Bengal elicited government concern by the 1840s. It's from the late 1840s that Tamil emigration begins to feature in the Madras archives, for example. Cases came to light in which seriously overcrowded native vessels crossed the water. As one observer wrote in 1848, it is notorious the crowded manner in which the vessels arrive at Penang. The consequences this year have been very fatal, many of the passengers having died on the way. While direct evidence is hard to find, there certainly aren't passenger lists for these vessels, it is very likely that the passengers included not only Tamil Muslims going to work in the urban economy of the Strait Settlements, but also some of the earliest Kangani recruits for the coffee plantations of the interior. By the end of the 1860s, just on the eve of the Great Expansion, the Chief Secretary of the Strait Settlements observed that there was a regular coolie emigration from the coast to Penang. Many ships belonging to Musalmen are employed in it, Muslims that is to say, and the number of persons who are thus brought over is believed to average 4,000 per annum. Beyond their role in the migration process, Tamil Muslims played an important role in shaping public ritual on the streets of Singapore and Penang, and perhaps in the interior too, though our evidence there is more limited. A local variant of the Mahram procession, for example, known as Boria, served as a site for the interaction of multiple communities on the streets of Penang throughout the 1850s and 1860s. And as Niall showed in his paper, the annual Urs, the procession in honor of Shahul Hamid, was a major public event that attracted participation yearly in Penang from communities far beyond the community of Nagore Muslims. Crucially, however, by the 1870s, Marakaya capital was increasingly invested in landed wealth. This very interesting book that's just come out by the Penang historian Salma Koo, who is, this is the product of 20 or 30 years' work on the Chulia of Penang, the Marakayas, or the Jawi Peranakan of Penang. And it's very interesting, the subtitle is Patronage and Placemaking Around the Kaptan Kling Mosque, which is what is pictured there. And land is crucial to the story that she tells. Land is crucial to the development of the Marakaya community from the middle of the 19th century, where they were increasingly marginalized in their trading activities, but invested their capital in landed wealth in Penang. And To take me towards the end of the story I want to tell today, one of the chief places they invested their capital was in the printing press. Tamil Muslims were crucial in the development of Tamil print culture across the Bay of Bengal. The introduction of the movable type lithograph led to a proliferation of small-scale Tamil printing in Singapore and Penang beginning in the 1870s, with the production of newspapers, most of them very short-lived, and books which range from manuals of Islamic instruction to genealogies of saints. The first Tamil language newspaper in the Straits, Thangai Nesan, was edited by Muhammad Said and published by the Jawi Peranakan Company in 1876. The very same publishers started one of the first ever Malay language newspapers, Jawi Peranakan, with its commitment to popularizing the Malay language. Conversely, many of the early Tamil Muslim publishing houses were backed by Chinese capital or printed at Chinese printers. Jawi Peranakan, the first Malay newspaper, is pictured on the right. On the left-hand side of the screen. On the right-hand side is Singai Nesan, which in the 1880s is the longest single run of a Tamil newspaper from the 19th century that we have from the Straits Settlements. There are about four complete years of Singai Nesan at the National Library of Singapore. This, too, was a Marakaya-backed publication. And Singai Nesan had subscribers across the Malay Peninsula, in Sumatra, Java, Siam, Indochina, and India. In an early message to its subscribers, Singai Nesan vowed that, quote, from now on we will print news of Singapore, Penang, Malacca, Europe, Nagapattinam, Nagore, Karaikal, Madurai, Chennai, and Jaffna, suggesting the span of its subscribers' interests. And I'm struck by how it is both a very modern publication and yet one that gestures to much earlier itineraries, which had indeed taken Tamil-speaking Muslims across the archipelago. The layout of this, as every newspaper, resembled a collage, and the juxtaposition of stories is fascinating. The order of news ranged in every issue from the local to the global. That is to say, it started with the committee meetings of the local mosque, cases in Singapore's High Court, the racing results, robberies and murders. It then moved to a regional page which covered the Malay states, Netherlands, India, Siam and Indochina, and from there to India, China and Europe. Interestingly, Singai Nesan very often translated directly world news from English language newspapers, reproduced Reuters telegrams from around the world, which encompassed everything from war reports to news of the King of Bulgaria. What is striking to me is that the immobilization of Marakaya capital, combined with their continued physical and cultural circulation between South and Southeast Asia, provided some of the conditions for the development of more settled diasporic institutions. And if I may just briefly take us into the 20th century, Tamil Muslim print networks, though largely supplanted by Tamil Hindu newspapers by the 1920s, remained an important outlet for intellectual and literary creativity. Tamil-speaking Muslims in Penang were, for example, very closely involved in the debates about reform and ritual, spurred by the 1929 visit of Periyar E.V. Ramasamy to Malaya and Singapore. Just a couple of remarks to conclude, then, with ways in which this 19th century history might help us to reconnect early modern and modern histories of the Bay of Bengal, the Indian Ocean more broadly. I think a lot of work remains to be done in terms of a more detailed analysis of the financial networks of the Chettiars on the one hand and the Marakayas on the other. And the Japanese historian Professor Hamashita, who's an expert in China and the China Sea, has increasingly started to do absolutely fascinating work, going back to Cebu's point about intersecting financial diasporas, trade diasporas, of Chettiar-Chinese interactions in the Straits Settlements through the 19th and 20th centuries. The other avenue which Ronit Ricci has begun to explore along with Torsten Schacher is the literary history of that 19th century polyglot Arabo-Tamil Muslim world, where manuscript printing sort of moved and transformed itself in the 1870s to the production of some of the earliest Tamil language newspapers anywhere in the world. And that sense of the movement of ideas, of cross-fertilization, debate that spanned the Indian Ocean is something that I think we can do much more with. Thank you very much.